Ovarian cancer is difficult to detect in its early stages. In its advanced form, it's very difficult to treat and kills more than 14,000 women in the United States every year. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While many doctors and researchers focus their efforts on coming up with ways to detect ovarian cancer earlier, my first guest today is focused on awareness. Jody Kavensky lost her mother to ovarian cancer. In her memory, she founded the Norma Lee Foundation in Davenport. I'll talk with her. We'll hear the stories of two women who survived ovarian cancer, and I'll talk with Dr. Michael Goodhart of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ovarian cancer is difficult to detect, and when the cancer is advanced, it's difficult to treat. Today, I'll talk to a number of people whose lives have been touched and altered by ovarian cancer. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Carrie Stevens. She's a cancer survivor from DeWitt. Laura Shaver is also a cancer survivor, and she's now invested her expertise and money and energy into fighting the disease, founding the Clarity Foundation. And then later in the hour, I'll talk with Dr. Michael Goodhart of Gynecological Oncology at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. My first guest today lost both her mother and her aunt to ovarian cancer. In their honor, she founded the Norma Lea Foundation based in Rock Island to raise awareness about the disease. Jody Kavensky, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity, and good morning.
I want to start with your mother's story today. How old was she when she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer?
She was 64, which is pretty much the average age of diagnosis.
And how was it discovered?
She says she floated to the top of her bath. She had been having problems for many, many months and spent a lot of time in a gastroenterologist office, which is very often the case. And by the time it was discovered, she was stage 3C. And they put her right in for surgery.
And what other kinds of treatment did she endure after surgery?
She went through 5 separate rounds of chemotherapy, and she had a liver resectioning after that, and she also had a bowel blockage. So she had 3 surgeries altogether and 5 rounds of chemotherapy in 7 years.
Wow.
It was a tough road.
At any point during those 7 years, did it seem like the fight was over, that she was going to get better?
At times when she was in remission, yes. You know, it's interesting. Now the doctors are treating it as a chronic disease because you can live. At the point that she celebrated her 5-year of survival, she was now a statistic on the other side. She was one of the 25% instead of 75%. So we did, yes, we had a lot of hope at that point.
When did she die?
She died in June 1st, 2008.
Did you have a history of cancer in your family?
Well, her sister also had ovarian cancer. She had a grandmother who died of stomach cancer, but of course in the 1930s, they did not have the medical technology. And so we don't know if it was ovarian or another gynecological cancer. Interestingly, during my mother's progression of her disease, she did have the genetic testing, and I know that Laura is going to speak a lot about that. Laura hopes that we put her out of business someday with what we're doing. But my mother did have the genetic mutation for it, which I unfortunately inherited from her.
If you have that genetic mutation, what does that mean for you?
It means that I have a 30% higher risk than the general population of developing ovarian cancer. And that's what our foundation is really trying to do, is we're trying to empower women with knowledge about the disease and educate them about the symptoms so that they can take proactive measures. They will seek out help earlier, and the disease will be found earlier when it is much, much more treatable.
A lot of us lose people that we love to cancer. Clearly, this was a galvanizing experience for you. Why do you think it made you want to start a foundation and raise awareness?
oh gosh, you give me goosebumps here. About 2 months before my mother passed away, we were sitting at a kitchen table, and she said, why doesn't someone do something about ovarian cancer? Everything's breast cancer. And I said, Mom, there's no survivors. I said, but someday I will try and do for ovarian cancer what the Susan G. Komen Foundation has done for breast cancer. And the night my mother died, I was laying in bed, and I came up with this name that it should be named after my mother and her sister. My mother always thought she was a little bit unnormal because that L was missing from her name, Norma. So this made her normal again, and it was founded
putting the name Norma and Leah together gave an L at the end of Norma. Okay.
Exactly, and it was such a strong feeling that sisters, and I have a sister I'm very close to, that sisters share a lot of things, but ovarian cancer shouldn't be one of them. And when Paula Sands had announced that she had ovarian cancer, that's really when the foundation got up and running, because in all good conscience, I couldn't sit by and watch Paula fight this fight alone. So I reached out to her. And
for our listeners who don't know who Paula is, can you tell me?
Paula is, well, I refer to her as our Oprah Winfrey of the Quad Cities, but she is a talk show host on the NBC affiliate KWQC and has been very, very vocal about the disease and took all of her viewers on her journey through her chemotherapies, through her wig shopping, through one time she even took her wig off so they saw what she looked like without it. And she has just been she's our teal warrior princess.
You want to do for ovarian cancer what Susan G. Komen Foundation done for breast cancer. And that's a very tall order. First, let's talk about spreading the message about the symptoms of ovarian cancer. Because when you read about this disease and you read about the symptoms, it's not an experience that makes you feel very optimistic, because these are symptoms that every woman has at some time or another. What are the symptoms?
Well, we've come up with I should say we have borrowed from across the pond in England a BEAT ovarian cancer concept. And BEAT is the acronym for bloating that is persistent, eating less and feeling fuller, abdominal pain, and trouble with your bladder and bowels. So that's BEAT. Most women will experience these at any given time in their life. However, if they are persistent and are happening at the same time for more than 2 or 3 weeks, most women will think that it is a gastroenterology problem when it's actually a gynecological. They should be pursuing both avenues. They should see a gynecologist about these.
Is this also a matter of raising awareness among doctors? Because I'm sure a lot of women wind up in a gastroenterologist's office with these symptoms, and I'm sure they do their very best to figure out what's going on. But is there also a learning curve for doctors to say, wait a minute, this might not be the right avenue?
Absolutely. And we are working with some local doctors and trying to figure out how the best way to educate this group is. We have some contacts up in Washington, D.C. that are going to be helping us along. We developed this BEAT mirror card that women can put on their mirrors, and it is being distributed by local doctors so that they, as we bring up their awareness, they're helping us get to all the women who have no idea that this might be happening to them.
When, as the hour goes on, we'll talk more about risk factors and how you can assess your own personal risk for ovarian cancer. But I want to talk about how you've been able to reach out to others. Your foundation is still fairly youthful. How far do you think you've been able to get so far?
Well, in the year since we really started, we've probably gone where it would take most organizations 3 or 4 years. I have a background in marketing. I've been in the community for 25 years. And once you set your mind to do something, you find a way to get it done. We've been very, very fortunate with our media partnership with Paula and KWQC. And we will be working a lot more in getting some mirror cards out to different areas. They are now in about 14 different states and 4 other countries. And we just need to start raising the funds. to be able to expand our message and our efforts. And with September being Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, we have been able to get a lot of awareness materials with teal tags that we put on businesses. We've lit some buildings in teal, very prominent buildings in the Quad Cities. And being in the Labor Day parade, where we gave out almost 2,000 ovarian cancer mirror cards, was really something.
And you mentioned teal. Of course, everybody associates pink with the fight against breast cancer. Teal is ovarian cancer.
Yes, teal is the new pink. It is the color of ovarian cancer, and it's really a very hot color now. So if you want to wear teal and support ovarian cancer, go shopping this fall because it's in all the stores.
That must be feel like a nice coincidence to you. You have a major event planned for September 29th. Tell me about it.
Yes, that's our night to beat the Big O. Beat the Big O is pretty much our rallying cry as we rise up against ovarian cancer. It will be at Crow Valley Golf Club in Davenport, Iowa. We have Ellis Kell and the Who's Dads, Anthony Catalfano, who is a jazz pianist. Paula Sands will be there. We will have all the usual auction and raffle activities, but with a few twists. So it will be a party like you've never seen before, which is how we are advertising it.
Have you heard from any women who have gotten your cards and heard of the foundation in the last year who have discovered that they have ovarian cancer?
Several, I'm sorry to say. Just the other night I was out at dinner and saw someone who has a business with teal tags and was with someone who had just had a daughter be diagnosed with it. And it's very important to reach out and bring these women up to speed on all the different technology that's available to help them really fight the disease.
Do you think that some of these women have discovered their cancer because of the work you've done?
I'm hopeful, but I can't have any predictive abilities from what's happened in the past. One thing that will help us in the future is the fact that all of the hospitals are now required by law to have everything on the computer, and by putting in a few different variants, we can pretty much determine if the beat cards, what's happened before the beat cards, what happened after the beat cards, as far as what individual doctors' offices see in their diagnoses and their testing procedures. And those systems are what we are going to be working on within the next year.
So you're probably not thinking very far past September 29th right now. I'm sure you have a lot of last-minute stuff to do. But just very briefly, what do you see in the future for the Normalia Foundation?
Well, once we get as many of these beat cards distributed to as many people as we can, and there are tests, once there is a test that will diagnose it, then we will be lobbying with the insurance companies to get it covered. Right. But I just want to say one other thing, that a pap smear does not detect ovarian cancer, and that is a big misunderstanding out there.
All right. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Jody.
Thank you.
Jody Kavensky is the founder of the Normalia Foundation based in Rock Island, Illinois. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about ovarian cancer, a disease that kills more than 14,000 women in the United States every year. It's a cancer that's difficult to detect, and when it's advanced, it's extremely difficult to treat. Right now, I'm going to talk to a couple of different survivors of ovarian cancer, and then later in the hour, I'll talk with Dr. Michael Goodhart of the Gynecological Oncology Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me now is Carrie Stevens of DeWitt, Iowa. She is a survivor of ovarian cancer. Carrie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And your story is not typical. Jody just mentioned a few minutes ago her mother's story and when she was diagnosed in her 60s and how that is typical. Mm-hmm. You clearly were not diagnosed in your 60s. You were 34 years old?
34, yeah.
How was your cancer discovered?
I was actually pregnant with my son. At my 19-week my pregnancy was a high-risk pregnancy because I had heart surgery when I was young, so they were monitoring me rather closely. I went in for a level 2 ultrasound, and they noticed that there was a mass on my left ovary that at that point in time they thought was just a cyst. They continued to monitor it, and it continued to grow throughout the pregnancy, which was cause for concern. And then after my son was born, they were so worried about it that they went in and removed it, tried to remove it, and it came back being cancerous, and they ended up having to remove my left ovary as well.
How old were you, was your son when you had that surgery?
3 months old.
Wow.
So that was scary knowing that I had a small infant at home and I'm recovering from surgery, and it put a lot of pressure on my husband and my family, but they've been just unbelievably supportive.
The tumor was discovered really because you were pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, that's just a wonderful blessing that it was discovered then. But at the same time, discovering that you have a tumor while you're pregnant, what did you feel when you found that out?
Well, at that point in time, we weren't even sure that it was cancer. So I was trying to be optimistic, thinking, oh, it's just going to be a cyst. I'll be able to go in for laparoscopic surgery. Normal laparoscopic surgeries, you can be home the same night, thinking I would be home to my son. And waking up in recovery, having them tell me that they had to open me because it was cancerous was just devastating. I was terrified. My only thought was, okay, now what's next? So it's been a interesting road, and my family, I have such a good support group. It's been overwhelming.
That was 5 months ago. Your son is 8 months old now,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
How is your health now?
I feel great. I just concentrating on raising my son, and I still go for periodic checkups every 3 months. They're still monitoring me because I do still have my right ovary, and it does increase your risk of developing cancer in the opposite ovary. So they're still monitoring me rather closely, but I feel good.
Do you have a history of cancer in your family?
There's cancer, not necessarily ovarian. I have an aunt that died from colon cancer. My grandfather died from lung cancer. So there is cancer in my family, but as for gynecological cancers, there's no known history in my family anywhere. So this was really a surprise when it came back cancerous.
Was there anything in your own personal history to lead you to believe that you might be predisposed or at risk for cancer?
Nothing, really. I was born with a hole in my heart, so I had heart surgery before I turned 5 years old. But as for cancer, there's nothing to even cause us to suspect that it would end up being like this.
The surgery that you had to remove your ovary, did that remove all the traces of cancer?
They took my ovary in tube on my left side. They took some omentum, some lymph nodes, and some other tissues to do pathology, and they all came back normal, thankfully. So they caught it so early that it was only stage 1C. I did not have to go through any chemo or radiation, so I'm very thankful to have caught it so early than not have
right.
to.
Well, and you didn't even experience any symptoms. We were talking earlier about the symptoms of ovarian cancer.
Well, being pregnant at the
right.
point in time, you know, all of the symptoms I would have just associated with pregnancy anyway.
Right.
So.
Right. there's certainly a lot of that happens in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So at this point, we were talking earlier about the genetic testing that can be done. Have you pursued genetic testing?
I haven't yet. I am going to bring it up at my next checkup. To look into those things. I know my mother has never really had any testing done, and I'm going to mention that to her, that maybe that's an avenue that we might want to look into, just to make sure to see if there's any genetic possibilities there. It's nothing that's ever really crossed our mind because there have been no known cases in my family anyway. So I'm going to put that bug in her ear and see what she thinks.
And this is your first child.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hoping to have more children?
I'm hoping. I would like at least one more. I don't really want him to be an only child, but we're still in discussions about that and the risks involved with trying to have another.
Not only risks, but having lost one of your ovaries, have you talked to doctors about your fertility?
I have. They say that it shouldn't inhibit it too much, that I can still try for another. But they're hoping that once we are finished having children, they do want me to have my other ovary removed.
Having gone through this experience, what would you tell other women about ovarian cancer? What should we know?
Don't neglect your health. And if you feel symptoms of anything, don't be afraid to talk to your doctor. Be completely open and honest with everything. You only have this one life, this one body. You take care of it. If you suspect something's wrong, don't be afraid to ask questions.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carrie Stevens of DeWitt, a survivor of ovarian cancer. She was only 34 years old when she was diagnosed. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and I want to bring another cancer survivor into the conversation now. Laura Shaver is also an ovarian cancer survivor, originally from Davenport. She now lives in California. She's also the founder of the Clarity Foundation. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me your story. When were you diagnosed with ovarian cancer?
I was 49 when I was diagnosed. And I also was one of the lucky ones. You probably have told your listeners about the very poor statistics for ovarian cancer, that most women get diagnosed in late stage. And while the treatment initially works, most people recur. And when we recur, then it's a very, very difficult course. And the survival rate for the death rate from ovarian cancer has really not changed that significantly in 40 years. But so far, I'm very lucky in that I was diagnosed in 2006, and I got my life back. And that's why I started the Clarity Foundation, which was launched in 2008.
How was your cancer discovered?
My cancer was discovered because, once I moved to California and moved to San Diego, I said I wanted to learn how to surf, and I became a pretty avid surfer, and I felt pain when I was laying on my surfboard. And it was time for my annual pap and pelvic, and I thought, well, I better get in there for my annual exam. And I complained of, you know, when I was there for my examination, I said, you know, I have this pain when I'm laying on my surfboard. And the person said, well, let's get you, it was my doctor's nurse practitioner that was doing the exam, and she said, well, let's get you an ultrasound to rule anything out. And it was caught on ultrasound. And I had a grapefruit-sized tumor and was diagnosed on a Thursday before Labor Day weekend. And the following week went in and had my big surgery.
When you talk about having a pain when you were on your surfboard, how serious was it? How painful was it?
Well, I probably had been ignoring it for a long time. I mean, it was an unusual pressure. And I was, since I was 49 and perimenopausal, there were lots of, looking back on it, I probably had all of the symptoms. In fact, I did have all of the symptoms, but I was thinking, oh, you know, I'm starting to go through menopause. I had was really fighting that. I had gone on some hormone replacement a few months prior. I was thinking, oh, these are side effects from the hormone replacement. I got to get off of these. So I was using every excuse. And, fortunately, though, I went in, and fortunately, I was listened to and had the right diagnostic test so that they could I did not get to a later stage.
Well, it almost sounds like your doctor took your pain more seriously than you took your pain.
Right. Well, I owe my life to that nurse practitioner who did not say, oh, come back in 3 months, but said, let's get you an ultrasound to rule anything out. And I think that's very, very important for all the listeners to really push to, if they are having the symptoms of ovarian cancer and they're not listened to get what's called a transabdominal and intravaginal ultrasound. It's not an invasive test and it doesn't hurt. And, you know, they can, it's a good way to have a closer look around.
What kind of treatment did you go through?
I went through the typical chemotherapy that most women that are diagnosed with ovarian cancer undergo, which is six cycles of a drug cocktail called carboplatin and paclitaxel. But I'm a scientist by training and helped to develop a drug for kidney cancer called Sutent. And when we were doing the clinical trials, we would routinely do molecular profiling of patients that had kidney cancer or other types of cancer that we were testing our drug against. And so when I was diagnosed, I just said to myself, oh, I'm going to tailor my treatment for my tumor. I'm going to have my tumor profiled. And I found that Dr. Laura Shaver, the scientist, could profile tumors every day in the lab, but Laura Shaver, the ovarian cancer patient, couldn't get that done. Hmm. And that's why I was perplexed by this. I was mad about it. And even though I couldn't do anything for my treatment, it's why I started the Clarity Foundation. And really what women need with ovarian cancer is help if they recur, because the standard of care treatment, the same thing that I had, carboplatin and paclitaxel, works 80% of the time in that it shrinks your tumor and you get to what's called no evidence of disease. But unfortunately, for the women that are diagnosed in stage 3 or stage 4, which is most women with ovarian cancer, 80% of the time the cancer comes back. And after that, there's multiple choices for treatment, and there's no way to prioritize those treatments, and that's where the Clarity Foundation comes in.
And what do you offer patients?
We offer patients a series of laboratory diagnostic tests that are done on a tumor sample that can be obtained. For some women, we can go back to the archive block from surgery. Most women, however, either have a biopsy or oftentimes they are going in anyway for a second debulking surgery. We can use that those tumor specimens. We put them through a battery of laboratory tests that help to understand, well, what is amongst all of the choices for recurrent disease, how can one prioritize that? Importantly, you know, as a survivor, as a scientist, we want more cures for ovarian cancer. I recognize that's a big word, but we know that we're going to, in order to get those cures, we're going to have to combine with the right molecular targeted agent. So we have a panel to match to these molecular targeted agents that are now in clinical trials for ovarian cancer. So in short, Charity, it's a panel of tests that helps to prioritize either the next chemotherapy treatment or a choice of clinical trials.
How many patients have you been able to work with?
We've done just over 250 now, so the numbers are getting up there. We are, of course, trying to, we believe, and I certainly believe that every recurrent ovarian cancer patient should be offered molecular profiling, that insurance companies should reimburse for that. Ovarian cancer is very, very unusual in that it's very heterogeneous, meaning we're all different. And molecular profiling is something that's done commonly in other cancers. But one of the difficult things for ovarian cancer is if you take 100 of us and line us up against the wall, our tumors are likely very different and should be treated differently. It makes it much more difficult than other types of cancer.
Are you getting a lot of attention in the medical community?
we are beginning to get a lot of attention in the medical community. You can imagine that when we started doing this 4 years ago, it was a bit controversial. But as doctors are understanding that, number one, what we're trying to help them with is prioritize what they're from amongst the choices that they would normally give anyway. So these are all of the FDA-approved chemotherapies for recurrent ovarian cancer that are on the NCCN compendium, which is the doctor's handbook for how to treat cancers. You know, once they understand that, then they recognize even today that the way they choose the treatment is, I won't say pick out of the hat, but knowing or thinking that the drug has a high likelihood to work is not one of the reasons that they choose them. Typically, from the 5 or 6 drugs that are commonly used, if somebody has to come from afar, maybe they want to use an oral treatment so they don't have to come in every week to get their chemotherapy. Sometimes we're sick of losing our hair and we don't want to lose our hair again, so they'll do a chemotherapy that doesn't where you don't lose your hair. But really what we want is we want to get back into remission. And in order to do that, we feel that a panel of molecular tests to prioritize the treatment options is the way to go.
I'm talking with Laura Shaver. She is the CEO of the Clarity Foundation, Improving Treatment Options for Ovarian Cancer Patients. We'll continue our conversation in a moment and welcome Dr. Michael Goodhart to the conversation. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about ovarian cancer. And I've been talking this hour with survivors of ovarian cancer, the issue of raising awareness about this kind of cancer that is very difficult to detect in its early stages and difficult to treat in its later stages. And Laura Shaver is still with us on the line. She's an ovarian cancer survivor. She's also the CEO of the Clarity Foundation, which was founded, she founded it, to do molecular profiles of ovarian tumors. And joining the conversation now is Dr. Michael Goodhart of the Gynecological Oncology Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Goodhart, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
And we've talked a lot about ovarian cancer and different experiences with ovarian cancer this hour, but I want to spend a little time with you revisiting the basics of ovarian cancer. What is it?
Well, that's a very good question, and we know what it is as far as clinically, how patients present and everything, but as far as the molecular genetic background of ovarian cancer, we're very limited in our understanding. Ovarian cancer is basically a cancer that arises from the, we think, from the outside layer of the ovary called the epithelium, although there's a lot of data now that suggests that ovarian cancer actually might originate from the fallopian tube. Probably over the past 5 to 7 years, there's very convincing data that shows that, that the ovarian cancers we thought are classically of the ovary actually originate from the fallopian tube. I spoke on earlier about it's very hard to diagnose, and we typically only diagnose it in advanced stages. And the reason why, the symptoms are very subtle. When you look back at patients that are diagnosed with ovarian cancer and really question them extensively, they do actually have symptoms. But they're very subtle. Sometimes they're just a little GI symptoms, a little bloating, a little fullness, clothes maybe not fitting exactly right. But again, most people don't, you know, associate those symptoms with ovarian cancer.
It's just easy to explain them away.
It's very easy. Just like most of us, when we have a common everyday headache, we don't automatically think we have a brain tumor. But in some cases, some people do. So it's sort of like that. The symptoms are very subtle, and most people just kind of brush them off, and then unfortunately the cancer continues to grow and then presents at advanced stages when it's very hard to cure and treat. So
we've talked about in the past on this program, we spent an entire hour talking about mammography and some of the limitations of that test to detect breast cancer in its early stages. What can we do to detect ovarian cancer in its early stages?
That's a very, very good question and a very difficult question to answer. Unfortunately, there are no good screening tests currently for ovarian cancer. There are tumor markers that we use, and there are markers that we use once a woman is diagnosed with a pelvic mass to try to help determine, can they be operated on by a regular gynecologist, or do they need to be referred to a gynecologic oncologist, an ovarian cancer specialist, which is what I am. But as far as a general screening like a mammography or a PSA for prostate cancer that we screen the general population, we just are not there yet, unfortunately. This tumor marker called a CA-125, cancer antigen 125, is really not a very good screening test. So we typically would not advocate that people just start getting their blood drawn for this CA-125 because it can be falsely elevated in multiple other conditions. And we have a handful of patients that are referred to us that do get a screening CA-125 for one reason or another, and then we kind of end up sort of chasing our tail, and it incites a lot of fear and anxiety in the patients. And they don't have an ovarian cancer, but, you know, we're left with, you know, just a lot of questions as to why they have an elevated CA-125. Again, it can be elevated for multiple reasons. So as of yet, we unfortunately don't have a good screening test right now for ovarian cancer, but we're working on it. So.
Both of the women who are survivors that I talked to today were diagnosed with ultrasounds. Is there a thought that an ultrasound, an abdominal ultrasound, could be a screening test for this?
So that's a very good question. And we do use ultrasound in combination with CA-125 for patients who are at high risk for ovarian cancer. So, for example, if someone has a BRCA1 or BRCA2 that's a gene mutation, then we use that to screen people. Let's say they had a family history, or they themselves are BRCA positive, or they have a strong ovarian cancer, breast cancer family history. And then lots of times we use a combination of ultrasound and CA-125. But the questions that we really don't understand or don't have answers for are how often, what's the combination of CA-125 and ultrasound that is best used to detect this? Because the problem is you can do an ultrasound on day one that can be normal, and then, well, when do you do it again? Do you do it weekly, monthly, every 3 months, every 6 months? You know, those kind of questions just aren't very well worked – or those answers, rather, aren't very well worked out. What we would typically do at the University of Iowa for people that are at high risk for ovarian cancer is about every 3 months we would combine CA-125, ultrasound, and then pelvic examination by a healthcare provider to help sort of screen people. But again, it's less than optimal.
What makes someone high risk?
So people that are high risk have a strong family history of ovarian cancer in their family, like a first-degree relative. So, for example, if a daughter had a mother who had ovarian cancer, that would put her at high risk. If there's a strong family history of premenopausal breast cancer, so in other words, breast cancer that develops before the change of life in any first-degree relative. Or again, if anybody for whatever reason has been tested for the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene and they have a mutation, they would be at high risk as well. So those are the targets that they're really after. But again, you know, the people that are BRCA1 or BRCA2 positive are a very small segment of the total overall population of women that get ovarian cancer. Usually just about 10% of those women are associated with a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. 90% are what we would call sporadic ovarian cancers, meaning we just simply don't quite understand why they develop, unfortunately.
I'm talking with Dr. Michael Goodhart of the Gynecological Oncology Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're talking about ovarian cancer. Laura Shaver is also still with us. She is an ovarian cancer survivor and the founder of the Clarity Foundation, which does molecular profiles of the tumors of women who have ovarian cancer. If you have any questions for either of the doctors, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Goodhart, I have read that birth control pills, being on birth control, can actually reduce your risk for ovarian cancer, although it's also associated with an increased risk for other kinds of cancer, including breast cancer. Is that an important piece of the puzzle? Is that something women should be thinking about?
It is. You know, I certainly think that the birth control pills have been shown to decrease the risk of one developing ovarian cancer. And again, the original idea behind that was that when the cancers originate from the the surface coating of the ovary, when an egg is ovulated, that it disrupts that surface epithelium, that surface coating of the ovary. And therefore, when that repairs, it can the repair process can incorporate different mutations or alterations that can then lead to an ovarian cancer. So we do think putting patients on or people on birth control pills definitely decreases risk. That's been proven. The thing is that we're not 100% sure how that factors in now that, you know, we do think a lot of the ovarian cancers actually do originate from the fallopian tube, and we have some good objective evidence to show that. So it's kind of a little bit the picture is becoming a little bit cloudy now as to, you know, the actual mechanism of decreasing ovarian cancer by putting people on birth control pills. But, you know, I guess we don't have to understand everything. As long as it works, it works. So,
and Laura, I want to bring you back into the conversation. You mentioned that before your tumor was discovered, you were you had actually gone on some hormone replacement therapy. And I know that hormone replacement therapy interacts with breast cancer in some dangerous ways. Is there a connection between hormone replacement therapy and ovarian cancer?
Well, I think for me, it's unlikely. I had a clear cell histology, which probably arises out of endometriosis, unlike papillary serous, which probably arises from the fallopian tube. And so mine was probably there simmering for a long time, much longer than before I started my HRT, which was really only a few months before I was diagnosed.
Well, and as you mentioned, that tumor was the size of a grapefruit, so it probably had been growing.
Maybe hormones made that thing take off?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There have been some reports out recently that shown that some ovarian cancer subtypes, like, for example, the clear cell carcinomas or other types, are hormonally sensitive. But there are a lot of other studies that shown that they're really not. So the hormonal debate is, I think, for ovarian cancer is kind of still out there. But you do bring up a very interesting point that these different, what we call them histologic subtypes or different types of ovarian cancers, for example, the clear cells or the papillary serous or the endometrioid ovarian cancers, you know, they probably are very distinct genetically. And although we typically tend to treat most ovarian cancers as a group, you know, in the same manner, that's probably, and I bet you eventually we'll figure out that may not be the right thing. You know, earlier I was listening and you were talking about, you know, molecular profiling and genetic analysis. And I think, you know, as we move forward, we're going to realize that the genetic makeup or the makeup of the tumor is incredibly important in finding effective targeted therapy, which is what we're actually trying to do at the University of Iowa.
When someone with ovarian cancer, what are the treatment options?
So that's a very good question. And typically, most patients would hopefully be referred on to a gynecologic oncologist for surgery. So surgery is the mainstay for patients with ovarian cancer. And what we would do is do what's called a debulking surgery, whereas we, through a midline incision, we would remove as much of the tumor as we could. And then afterwards, once a patient gets healed up, we would go ahead and administer some type of chemotherapy. And there are a lot of different types of chemotherapy out there, some that go through the vein and then some that are actually put inside the abdominal cavity through a little special catheter that can be surgically implanted. But typically, it's surgery followed by chemotherapy. Those are the two main things that we use to battle ovarian cancer.
And Charity, if I could just echo what Dr. Goodhart was saying about how important it is that we get to a gynecological oncologist for our care, because an independent prognostic indicator of how we do is how extensive the debulking is. And the gynecological oncologists are trained in how to debulk the surgery. I can't tell you how many women I talked to that were suboptimally debulked.
And in layman's terms, what does that mean?
They couldn't. The surgeon did not remove all of the tumor.
That's exactly right. So I agree with you, obviously, as a GYN oncologist, 100%, that these women, to get their best chance of doing well, really should be referred to a GYN oncologist And here in the state of Iowa, we're fortunate enough to have a handful of them here at the university, and then there's also a group in Des Moines. But I definitely do agree. There have been multiple studies that have shown that surgery received by a GYN oncologist as opposed to a combination of other surgeons definitely improves your survival. So referral to a gynecologic oncologist is of utmost importance. And also, we're the ones that participate in all the active clinical trials. We have all the active research going on. I mean, this is what we do. You know, this is our job.
And if you think of ovarian cancer as a dandelion gone to seed, and it puffs out, and it seeds your peritoneal cavity, you have to have, you know, a surgeon that is trained in how to get out all of those seeds from that dandelion, and they go everywhere, and it takes a long time. It takes a trained eye. And it's very, very important that people not underestimate the complexity of the surgery.
We have just a few minutes left. And in the beginning of the hour, of course, I was talking with Jody Kavensky of the Normalia Foundation based in Rock Island. She is approaching the fight against ovarian cancer primarily by raising awareness. Laura, you are focusing on trying to find treatment options that are more specialized to each woman's needs. And I want to ask you and Dr. Goodhart each, so it's just in a couple of minutes, what steps do you think we need to be taking in the medical and research communities next to best fight ovarian cancer? Laura?
Well, thank you. Yes, so first of all, Clearty Foundation is for the too late, can't wait crowd. So we, you know, the people that are doing the early detection, we applaud them. That's what is needed. The people that are doing cures for the future, we applaud them. That's what's needed. Everything is needed. But we're for the women where it's too late for early detection and they can't wait for cures for the future. But I can tell you that ovarian cancer is underserved from, you know, and from a financial standpoint, from a research standpoint, from just putting dollars in. We need the dollars for early detection. We need the dollars for cures for the future. Clearty Foundation is about women battling ovarian cancer today, how to prioritize their treatment options today.
Laura, thank you so much. Laura Schaffer is an ovarian cancer survivor. She is also the CEO and founder of the Clearty Foundation. And Dr. Goodhart, you get the final say today. What do we need? What is most needed in the fight for ovarian cancer right now?
The most needed is basically more active research. We have a pretty active research program at the University of Iowa. I have a laboratory myself in addition to seeing patients, operating on patients, seeing patients in clinic. We run a laboratory which looks at the basic biology behind ovarian cancer, better ways to identify genes that are important. You know, ovarian cancer in general are genetic diseases, and we need to better understand the genetic basis of these cancers, and then we can come up with more targeted therapeutics that basically kill the cancer cells but don't, you know, harm the patients. Right now, most of the chemotherapies we have are very toxic to patients. So we just need basically more research, more money put into ovarian cancer research, and then more patients going on clinical trials. We have a large number of clinical trials open at the University of Iowa that we always encourage patients to go on. So, you know, we just a little more effort, but we're trying. We're definitely swinging at this, but, you know, we just kind of haven't hit a home run yet. But I think we will in time. So,
Dr. Goodhart, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dr. Michael Goodhart of the Gynecological Oncology Department at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, and you can find out more about the Normalia Foundation that's based in Rock Island on our Facebook page, on our website, or you can search for Normalia Foundation online. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about quilts. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.